Hello everyone, I'm George Myland. Thank you for coming to my channel. This is about Anzac Day. I'm George Myland. Thanks for coming to my channel, telling you about Anzac Day. So Anzac standing for Australia and New Zealand Army Corps. So it commemorates the landings at Gallipoli in 1915 during the First World War. But it's not just to commemorate those New Zealanders, Australians and Tongans who laid down their lives in the Great War for Civilization, but those who served in any conflict ever since. And that includes peacekeeping operations, including those who survived, didn't get wounded either. Obviously, particularly commemorating and adulating those who made the final sacrifice. So New Zealand and Australia had very small populations in the First World War and Second World War, and that's why they fused their armies to form the Anzacs. By the Second World War, that was different. But even in the 1960s, Australia had a smaller population than London, despite Australia having the eighth biggest country in the world. So going back to the First World War, the Ottoman Empire then was extant. Turkey was the core of the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire was, you know, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine, Syria, what's now Israel, some of Saudi Arabia and so forth. And the British Empire existed, and New Zealand and Australia were very much part of it. The mother country, the lion has roared to its whelp or whatever. Where if England wants a hand, then here it is. That was one of the songs singing at the time. So over 90% of Australians and New Zealanders were of British stock at the time. And there was they very much saw their futures tied to the United Kingdom. I know over a century later, it's completely different. Anyway, moreover, the empire was a unit in international law. When George V proclaimed war, that automatically meant the entire empire was at war. All right, so no progress being made on the Western Front, really. So that's why there were Easterners and Westerners debating in the British Empire military circles. Westerners say, we've got to concentrate on the Western Front. Easterners say, you know, make no progress, knock away the props, defeat Germany's weaker allies like the Ottoman Empire, and then Germany will fall. The other thing is, they say, we have to get breakthrough to the Black Sea so we can resupply Russia with arms, sailing to, you know, what's now Ukraine and so forth. Okay, so there'd been the 18th of March 1915, there was a naval operation to try and sail through the Dardanelles, through the Sea of Marmara, onto Istanbul, Constantinople, as Westerners called it, to bombard that, then the Ottoman capital. They'd capitulate quite easily. Well, it didn't work. The Dardanelles had been demined, but was remined very quickly. And then the Franco-British squadron lost five battleships in a day. The admiral took fright, turned around. Now, should he have persisted, maybe that would have been a sunk cost fallacy. Otherwise, it was all for nothing. He might have lost one or two more ships, but he could have completed his mission. Or would they all have been lost? We just don't know. But I can see why he blanched at the idea of carrying on, because, you know, these battleships could carry 1,000 sailors. Doesn't mean they're all going to be killed if it blew up or sunk because of a mine, but certainly some of them were lost. Okay, so the Allied armies have been assembling forces in the nearest areas they controlled, like Cyprus, Egypt, Malta, and then they sailed on there to land on the Gallipoli Peninsula, thinking if they could get to the heights of the Gallipoli Peninsula, or Gelibolu, as they call it in Turkish, they would control the Dardanelles, their guns would be over there, they could fire at the Turkish positions, they could demine the Dardanelles, be safe for the fleet to fire through. But, you know, the Allies never controlled like more than apparently 1% of that peninsula. There was also on the mainland Anatolia, there was a landing by French and Indian troops. So anyway, this was, they say, sort of Australia's and New Zealand's loss of innocence. The first time they fought a war with their very high casualties. And obviously they'd fought in the Second South African War, 1899 to 1902. And indeed, Australia only formed a Commonwealth, a single country, in 1900. Prior to that, the various states of Australia, the various colonies were all separate, Western Australia and Victoria and so on. They had a direct relationship with the UK, but not with each other. And that was decided that they would put these colonies together, call them states, and there'll be Australia would have to be a political entity. Previously, it was only a geographical expression. But anyway, this is the first time they had shockingly high casualties landing at dawn there. And the Ottoman army commander there was the redoubtable Mustafa Kemal, later known as Atatürk, who was the president of Turkey, 1922 to his death in 1938. This was meant to be a audacious and rapid strike to force the Ottomans out of the war very quickly, but that didn't work, and they got mired there, just the sort of trench warfare they tried to avoid. Now, the Australians and New Zealanders have been recruited quite recently, rushed through basic training. The British Army still didn't have a conscription to the next year, and not sure could they cope with this other very complicated tasks, given something more straightforward to do. And so it went on. Okay, so the fighting on right until till November. What was I going to say? So, and then who came out to assess the situation? Was it Kitchener? Whoever assessed the situation said, no, this is not very successful. So we were going to have to withdraw. And the Allies were very reluctant to do so, say loss of prestige, because there was this myth of white invincibility, the whites win, 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 and it would fatally undermine Britain's credibility in the Middle East, in South Asia, and so on. But nevertheless, he said that was a decision, and they withdrew very carefully. That was a very difficult and delicate operation, because obviously the Ottomans realized that the Allies are pulling out, then they can go all out for it, and the last few ones are going to be killed very easily. But they managed to do that incredibly cleverly, as quietly, as they put, at night only, and having various things to make guns fire, like some water dripping into a pan, and that will cause the trigger to fire to give the impression they were there. And it went very, very quiet in the Allied lines in January 1916. And the Ottomans thought, is this some sort of ruse? How are they so quiet? Took them a few days to be able to creep over the trenches and realize, no, they're really not there. But the Ottomans had a very rough time of it as well, because, of course, the Royal Navy was there, the French fleet, then bombarding the Ottoman trenches. They took very high casualties. Their medical service wasn't up to much. So many of them died of wounds who otherwise would have been saved. Sulva Bey, Chunuk Bey, these are some of the toponyms which are seared into the collective memory. So was it cataclysmic? What do you think? So Ian Hamilton, a mate of Churchill's, one of the people who was fighting there. There wasn't this stark distinction between Australian and British, or New Zealand and British, because, you know, as I say, they were almost all a British stock then, and very many of them were born in the UK, or their parents were born in the UK. That, you know, the national identities have separated much more over the century since then. John Monash was one of the famous Australians who fought there, and that's why that university in Melbourne named in his honour. Okay, so more Frenchmen were killed at this battle than Australians, but with France doesn't talk about it so much because they fought many bloody battles. Verdun was going on next year and killed way more people. So relative to that, the casualties for France weren't that huge. Remember, obviously, France had 35 million people back then. You know, Australia had something like 4 million. Most of the Australian army, also Anzacs, were there. So that's it. And so you can arrive there, walk up to some hill for a dawn service. I was in Istanbul this time. Well, God, it was 2013. I could have done it, but very lazily, shamefully, I didn't, when you think that some gave everything they had. And I remember some history of the battle was written in the 1950s, and the Australian historian said, you know, why usually a whole year passes and no Australian New Zealander visits it. Some of the old soldiers who survived it came to visit it, you know, in the later decades. In the 1970s, as part of the, you know, banana pancake trail or whatever, overlanders from London to Australia, some of the Australians and New Zealanders visited it where their fathers or grandfathers had fought. And more people came. Turkey really opened to tourism in a big way in the 1980s. Remember the early 90s, was it the sort of 75th anniversary of the battle? Was it Bob Hawke went and Tom Suchiler, then the Prime Minister of Turkey, the only woman to be Prime Minister of Turkey, they met there. And there's been enormous goodwill born out of this battle. I remember staying in a hotel called Anzac House in Çanakkale, the nearby Turkish town. And there's no enmity or animosity. There's also a great mutual respect for the martial qualities of either side. But obviously, it reminds people of the pity of war, this horrendous waste of young life and so forth. So Anzac Day, there were some pacifists who said it was exploited to glorify war. Others say, well, that's really not true and so on. There's a play about it, the one day of the year. But anyway, so that is really a day to honour the military in Australia and indeed New Zealand. Okay. So various, you know, governors, generals, prime ministers of the two countries have gone there and to reconcile with their Turkish counterparts. There's Anzac Cove, is in that bay where some of them landed. But there was, at the time, there were some Australian New Zealand troops who thought the British weren't pulling their weight and accusing them of, what's the word, of sipping tea when they should have been fighting. I don't know if there's any truth in that. I'm not saying that criticisms weren't valid. I mean, presumably there were at least a few bad British soldiers. You might find that in any army. So anyway, obviously some of the British soldiers were Irish, right? So that's a little bit about Anzac Day, a very significant event in the history of Australia and New Zealand, somewhat shaped the national character made Australia and New Zealand more reluctant to get in wars on behalf of the United Kingdom. So they're saying, this is very far away from Australia and New Zealand. What on earth has it got to do with us? The Ottomans haven't done anything to us. The Ottomans were not just Turks. Some were now what we call Iraqis or Jordanians and so forth. But it was an absolute top priority because they thought, if the Allies take this peninsula, they'll take our capital. And it wasn't a very industrialized country. Most of their armaments factories were in Istanbul. You know, their navy wasn't up to much. Their capital would have been flattened had the Royal Navy got to the Bosporus. So they might have been knocked out of the war. But it was very defensible topography, very steep hills, fairly easy to dig trenches in and stuff like that. So it was rather cold in winter, rather exposed. It was roasting in the summer. Goodness. So that is about the Battle of Gallipoli. Remember going to speech by Bob Hawke, the former Prime Minister of Australia, now the late Prime Minister, and him saying why they ought to apologise to the Stolen Generation, saying we can't honour our gallantry at Gallipoli if we don't also acknowledge when we've done wrong. All right. Thanks for watching my channel. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon. Did any PayPal, George Callan, 790@gmail.com. Goodbye.